Still pretty hot in here. So Ed gave a pretty good talk last night about food, real food, and the importance of nourishment in our culture right now, in particular. And so I'd like to continue talking about this, the samadhi of nourishment, if you will, how we might create a state of concentration in which we are able to nourish and be nourished, to provide support for our connection to each other and everything else, to provide the conditions for ecstasy and refreshment. So at a certain level of tiredness for myself, everything disappears, all this disappears. It's just like Buddhism is an edifice. It just falls down when I get to a certain level of tiredness. Now something in my body holds steady. It comes to Raza and it follows the schedule, doesn't even quibble about it or have the thought of not doing it. It holds steady. But the rest of me becomes just naked flesh that wants release from my tiredness or my pain. And I seek what flesh seeks, comfort or ease or cooler weather or ice or food or water, whatever it is, at a certain level of tiredness that happens. And then my energy comes back up and I can be a Buddhist again. All this comes back. So when we first arrived, I think it was Sunday, and sitting in the Zendo on Monday, it was so hot. I think that day was 110 or 11 or more. And it was very hard. I sat there and it was so hot. And I was only aware of my feet swelling and my face melting. It just felt like it was melting into the robe. And I followed very closely and mindfully the little rivulet of sweat that kind of started in my collarbone and neck and then went into my robe. And if they were in a spot where I wasn't leaning on anything, they went all the way down to my thoracic spine. So I wondered at this point on Monday night, why are we doing this? My edifice was crumbling. And I didn't, you know, go beyond that question, why are we doing this? Because I was doing it. As I said, there's something in me that holds steady regardless of the circumstances. But then I wondered, you know, I just came as a visitor and experienced a hot day. You all are working so hard. I've seen people in jokes on this week. Many people are tired and still giving their all. People are working so hard, heat or not, working more than their work day in some cases. So Tassahara is well covered this year. That's good. But you can tell, you know, just being the recipient of this hard work, how wholehearted it is. And so, why are people doing this under these strenuous circumstances? And I think that it's because of bodhicitta, way-seeking mind. And the most satisfying aspect of my job as a teacher is to watch bodhicitta arise in people and completely derail their plans. For instance, I have people and students who are trying to save $2 million for their retirement. I know young people who want to rise to the top of their profession, whatever that is. And I know people who are raising children, want to do the best by their children, to sacrifice what they're doing now for their children's sake. And I know people who want to buy a dairy farm in Oregon and raise goats, people who are planning to do all this. And I know lots of people who want to be shining bodhisattvas and save the world, one homeless person, one Republican at a time. So, I know people who have elaborate plans like this. But they, right in the midst of all this effort that they make, they become themselves instead. Whatever it was, whatever it is, they become themselves. And they become an ordinary person, mired in grief and in delusion. But paying attention, sitting zazen, and paying attention. Bodhi means awake. Citta means perception. So this is seeing things like an awake person, bodhicitta. And awake-seeking mind refers to every one of us having this capacity. Every one of us inherently awake. So despite our individual circumstances of birth or education or class or all the other ways that people differ from each other, despite all that, each of us has awake-seeking mind and is inherently awake. And all of you are aware of it. So it just means way-seeking mind, that it can be instructional. This yearning in you can actually guide your life, which is why plans made from other sources, other aspects of you, are so often derailed or just slip by while you do something else. So it means to me that just the way we are, we're vital and heroic and stout-hearted. So what I want to talk about tonight is nourishment, how we can nourish way-seeking mind here in this very valley, which has its own challenges. It's not like out in the city or in an office or something like that, but it does have its own challenges. So I think the most nourishing thing in the whole world is connection. You can even get nourishment from your suffering if you're connected to it, if you don't turn away from it. So if you are connected, that is the deepest nourishment there is. And I'd like to talk about a couple of aspects of that. The first one, which many of you have heard me talk about before, is body-to-body connection. Just all of us sitting in this room digesting at the same time. Our bodies feel this as deeply nourishing, deeply reassuring. And we're all sitting zazen. At the same time, our bodies see this as a source of trust. This is a source of trust, a container to hold us. And all of these forms, it's the same thing. You're bowing with other people. This is all body to body, sources of trust and connection. the priest and the doan during a service are intimately connected. They're desperate during a service. And so in my, with students, I emphasize this quite a bit. We go rafting, canoeing, rebuilding on the beach, that kind of thing. Spend a lot of body-to-body movement time together. And also, if you're in a raft, you're very dependent on other people being in a raft too. So this is actually an extension of being in this room together, doing this kind of activity together, and moving around each other, like in ceremonies or in the kitchen, you know, any kind of work you do with other people. When I go on long trips like New York, I always take a student, and it becomes, you know, a cauldron. You know, like Marvin Murphy, the student I took to New York for 2 weeks a few months ago, he said to me afterwards, he said, "You can only hold your breath so long, and then you have to just be yourself." This is very intimate. I mean, because we're moving around each other all the time, we did several one-day sittings, we did a three-day sitting, and we were at the disposal of the group that we went to see. We were the guests. And so they were our priority, you know, doing what they asked us to do, coming and show them some forms and some things like that. And so we were always moving around each other. And we've seen, you know, all the way from the early morning while I'm exercising, you know, in my nightgown, Marvin comes in to make tea and get the morning going. So after about a week, I mean, this becomes very close. And what happens is, if you're really meeting each other, you just go further in, further and further and further. So I asked him after about a week, did he mind if I criticized him relentlessly? And he says, you know, Marvin, this is just what it is. Well, all right. It was the most intimate we've ever been. We completely rebelled after a couple more days. I asked him to sit down at lunch because they, you know, the Sangha we were with was going to ring a bell, and he was the last one standing because he served me. So I asked him to sit down before he got his lunch, meaning that after the bell, he could still get the lunch. And he just looked at me and went and got his lunch. And everybody sat there in horror. We processed it. Anyway, this is very important, is moving around each other in this implied agreement, this body-to-body intimacy. There's no point. That's gone. There's just meeting each other in whatever way you can. This is so deeply nourishing. It is unlike any other kind of relationship. From this point of view, romantic love seems ungrounded. Social relationships seem silly. From this point of view, from a practice point of view, if you have this kind of experience, you never want any other kind of relationship. I mean, you can mix and match. I mean, you can have social relationships and lover relationships with people you practice with. It's not mutually exclusive, but it becomes imperative when you experience this to meet other people. And you will put up with a great deal of bullshit from somebody who will meet you. The first person I ever met like this was my teacher, Baker Rosen. And you know, it was a very dramatic and in its way a very connected relationship. So I mean, you will put up with a lot because of this intimacy, this kind of connection, which is at base body to body. This is what is needed. The body understands this. Oh, I have to skip all this stuff. But I did want to mention a couple of things. And then another thing, in this valley, this very connecting, it's just incidental kindness. The incidental kindness that we do each other. I'm going down the steps in the dark. Someone offers their hand. It's a hot day. There's ice water, you know, at my workplace. And this is the kind of thing that makes you feel very connected to other people. Other people have noticed that you need something, and they're there to provide it. That's very intimate. It's not pro forma courtesy. It's intimate. It's to your needs. And then the other connection that I think is very important is with your own greed, hate, and delusion. Now, we've been studying, I came down with a group of people that are close to me, to study the jewel mirror samadhi. And this is by Tozan Ryokai, a poem written in the 9th century. And Tozan Ryokai is the founder of Soto Zen. And Soto Zen, in case you haven't appreciated it lately, was revolutionary, absolutely revolutionary, coming on the heels of a Buddhism in which there were hindrances and things to be purged and purified. It said, forget all that, that's hopeless. We're just flesh, body, mind, this flesh, this greed, hate, and delusion, it will never be at an end. And if you've ever done mindfulness practices on your own greed, your own ill will, irritation at all, and your own delusions, in other words, your own points of view, you will readily come to this conclusion that it will never end. So what was so radical and encouraging about Soto Zen is that greed, hate, and delusion are the path. They're the path. So this was a very radical teaching, greed, hate, and delusion as Buddha nature. And not to try to get rid of it, but mindfulness becomes the central practice. Mindfulness, to see what you're made of. You're already awake, so you use the practice of mindfulness to discover and find out who you are. Simply willing to be who we are rather than escaping who we are. This is very dramatic and revolutionary. It's almost impossible to stand to be who you are. And this is how Zazen comes in handy, because it gives you the stability to look in the mirror without flinching, which is Krimpo Rinpoche's definition of compassion. So this is appreciating the human tragedy or the human comedy, depending on your temperament. This is appreciating. There's no escape from it. Just to have a transformative understanding of the nature of the problem is liberating. A transformative understanding of the nature of the problem. There's no escape. So mindfulness is the basic practice. Now this is generally seen by students as boring. Just mindfulness. People would much rather fight demons. They would much rather have arguments with other people and then process. It's just very hard to watch your stuff. It's sickening, actually. And after some years, you really get sick of it. And you start to be interested in other people. You just exhaust the possibility. Yeah. So other people come swimming into you. So, to be deeply embedded in just this, just who you are this very moment, is deeply nourishing. Your own grief never ends. Your own resentment. That might suspend itself for a minute or two. Your own delusion never ends. You only have these 2 hours to see Alice. How could you not be delusional? And then another thing that I think is very important in this battle as far as nourishment for our practice is a rhythm for work, an understanding of work that combines both form and emptiness. It is illuminated by both form and emptiness. So we call this simultaneous inclusion, including form and emptiness at the same time. The particulars of your work, task A, task B, task C, and when it has to be done by, and what the priorities are, those are the particulars. And then the flow. This is emptiness or the absolute, whatever you want to call it. Just the flow of it, just getting out of bed in the morning, going to the zendo, doing soji, service soji, having breakfast, getting changed for work. So you're always just flowing from thing to thing. There's no sense of transition. You just dip your hands into the river of activity when you wake up and take them out of the river and go to bed. So this combination of the particulars and the flow is an extremely refreshing way to look at your work. If you see the flow, you'll never be interrupted, you'll never be diverted. It's just one thing after another. And then you come into the world of particulars to set your priorities and order your tasks and get the equipment that you need. So this is important in the summer at Tassajara when there's so much to do, and it's possible to resent doing it, to just get into the flow and come out for the particulars and take them back in with you. There are 2 lines from the Jhumir Samadhi that are a poetic way of expressing this that I particularly like, always loved me, long before I knew about absolute morality. They resonated with me. As you know, Zen literature, Zen poetry can resonate with you even if you have no idea what it means. There's something in you that kind of gets it. And these lines for me are, when the wooden man begins to sing, the stone woman gets up to dance. Relative and absolute, they're all at once. The screen in this movie, the sky and its clouds. The stone woman breaking into these great movies. It just thrills me to think of the one breaking up into the colorful moving man. So I think of those lines as describing the optimal work situation. The flow becomes the many. The flow is calm, carries you along, and the many is, you know, all the stuff you're going to express yourself with. and then wholeheartedly. So it's good to let go of being cool. That detached, remote attitude that means that you're hip enough to be alienated. I went to Baja in the fall. I was the trip on a kayaking trip. I was the trip meditation teacher. It's great to live in California. So I led the meditation on the beach every day. And we had Halloween. We had Halloween while we were there. So a couple days before, I told everybody, gather stuff for an altar, a Halloween altar. And I'd taken a copy of the Buddhist Sweet Dew, several copies, and to do the Sagasti ceremony, and ask people to make a list of names for things of the people who had died that year so they could be read. And people just over the days gathered on top of this rock, you know, incredible skeletons of birds and a whole pelican, the skeleton of a pelican, the whole skin of snakes, shells, glass, all kinds of, there's a law where we were against taking anything from the island. So people gathered these things here. And we did a Sagasti ceremony. We called up demons. I'd ask people to bring noise makers. So we stepped up to the altar individually. It was a group of only about 12 people. Each one stepped up and called up his or her personal demon. These are not Buddhists. There was only one student of mine who went, and the rest were mishmash. And believe me, they were nervous. But they got into it. They called up their own personal demons, and some of these things were very moving as people. One woman said goodbye to her ex-husband, a rancorous divorce, and that he died before they had a chance to get on there. And she had quite a bit to say to the altar. And she stepped back and someone else stepped up. Then we read the names of the dead and ended the ceremony, and we went and had margaritas. And so there was a woman on the trip, a very wealthy woman, she had told us. She had an apartment in San Francisco and a house in Aspen. And she was, among the women on the trip, we just couldn't wait till after meditation when we could see what she was wearing. She had the most incredible rack. To me, racking clothes is an old torn t-shirt, plastic shorts, to dry fast, and Tevas, and a baseball cap. Well, I didn't even know it was possible to have clothes like this. This incredible wetsuit-type outfit with little cap sleeve jackets and gorgeous stuff. Anyway, she came up to me after the ceremony and said, she was near tears. I could see she was moved. Now, there was a cool person. She was always making some very funny remark to put things down. And very critical of the crew in a funny way. Amusing way. Anyway, she came up and she was near tears and she said to me, I'm moved by that. She said, I really would like to stay in touch. And I said, well, what was so moving? And she said, I don't think I've ever seen adults behave like children. She said, you all just threw yourself into that dance as if it meant something. is very touching. So I have about 5 minutes, so I want to cut here to the last thing I want to say, which is another aspect of connection, which I personally think is very important, is to see everything you do as having, see all your behavior as having political implications. So this is a state of concentration that connects you to all the people in the world. So there is a stereotype of Zazen or any kind of meditation as kind of too quiet or quietism or something like that, but it's no help to suffering people. But I think that's so wrong, because you don't shut out the world with Zazen, as you know. You are smack up against the source of all the world's problems. Right as you sit there, in your own mind, you see what the problem is. There's nowhere to hide. So far from being quiescent or shutting out the world, it just puts you right in touch with what the problems are. And people use all sorts of things to avoid this understanding. Shopping and TV and our current cultural favorite, business. But in Zazen, there's no place to run to. So if you sit on a cushion and let loose of some of your compulsion to inflict your opinions on other people, and if you begin to understand that facing yourself is such a profound and brave thing to do, because the whole world involves in escaping from yourself. Everybody wants to escape from yourself. It's very profound and brave to face yourself, to just sit still and say, oh my gosh, I can't believe this. I can't believe this is my motivation for hurting that person. So if you vow to develop the stability to enable you to open your heart mind to every single thing, this helps the world more than starting a revolution. In fact, this probably is a revolution. So hardly anybody can stand to be with themselves and their greed, hate, and delusion long enough to deeply penetrate our suffering and the world's suffering. So please, this summer at Help the Heart, please save us all. Thank you very much.